Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Tamika Middleton of Women's March, who talks about the broad pro-democracy coalition's planned June 14th nationwide anti-authoritarian protests, likely to be the largest since Donald Trump returned to the White House. Craig Mochaber, former director of the New York office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, who examines Israel's seizure of a Gaza-bound humanitarian aid ship and calls for the UN to convene under a Uniting for Peace in Gaza resolution. And Colin Reese of the group Oil Change International, who explains how the Trump GOP budget bill will slash clean energy incentives that reduce pollution, created hundreds of thousands of jobs, and lowered electricity bills. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Five members of a United Nations humanitarian aid convoy were killed on June 2nd in North Darfur as fighting rages between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, militia, which controls most of Darfur in western Sudan. The convoy was headed toward the provincial capital of El Fasher, a city of 2 million people under siege by RSF militia forces. Both sides have accused each other of striking the UN convoy with drones. The UN did not say how the attack happened, but officials called for an urgent investigation and for the perpetrators to be held accountable. The UN convoy was attacked while attempting to reach children and families in El Fasher with life-saving food and nutrition supplies. The city is the last major population center in North Darfur under army control, where thousands now face starvation. Civilians and military personnel there have been under attack by the RSF for over a year. Overall, 4 million people have fled the violence in Sudan, and nearly 12 million people have been displaced. It's estimated that up to 150,000 have been killed in the last 2 years of war. Over 200 wildfires have broken out in the prairie lands of Canada, forcing more than 25,000 people to flee their homes in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. A prolonged period of unusually warm and dry conditions have intensified these fires, continuing a trend worsened by the climate crisis. Canadian authorities say that more than half these fires that are sending smoke to the U.S. are burning out of control, with some being monitored but allowed to burn. So far this year, wildfires have consumed over 494,000 acres of forests, three times the annual average of timberland burned over the past 5 years. The provinces of Manitoba and Saskatchewan have declared states of emergency, with several Indigenous communities being hard hit. Health impacts of wildfire smoke can be severe. Exposure to fine soot particles from wildfires can have long-term damaging effects on the heart and lungs months after a fire has ended. Research scientists have concluded that thousands of people die each year in the U.S. from exposure to wildfire smoke, creating billions of dollars of additional costs to the economy. In the early days of the Trump administration, more than a dozen White House officials and key congressional aides sold shares of stock in advance of economically consequential presidential policy announcements, such as Trump's imposition of tariffs on dozens of nations. ProPublica reports that even if these trades were not made with insider information, it creates the appearance of impropriety and undermines faith in government and the markets. Attorney General Pam Bondi sold between $1 and $5 million worth of shares of Trump Media, the president's social media company, on April 2nd. After the market closed, Trump announced his tariff plan that crashed the stock market the next day. Sean Duffy, Trump's transportation secretary, sold shares in almost three dozen companies on February 11th, 2 days before Trump announced plans to institute wide-ranging reciprocal tariffs. Tyler Gellish was a congressional aide who helped write the law on insider trading by government officials and now runs a nonprofit focused on transparency and ethics in capital markets, said, "I don't think members of Congress and executive branch officials should be trading securities. To the extent they have investment holdings, it should be managed by someone else outside their purview. The temptation to put their own personal self-interest ahead of their duties to the country is just too high." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
For months, planning has been underway for what may be the nation's largest single day of anti-Trump protests on June 14th, expressing opposition to the president's authoritarian white supremacist agenda, corruption, incompetence, and suppression of free speech. The protests, called No King's Day, are being organized in more than 1,800 cities and towns across the U.S., coinciding with Trump's planned military parade in Washington, D.C., celebrating the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary and the president's 79th birthday. The June 14th protests also come as Trump federalized 4,000 California National Guard troops and deployed 700 Marines to Los Angeles after the eruption of protests against militarized ICE deportation raids. The president issued a memorandum federalizing the National Guard troops over the objection of California Governor Gavin Newsom, who in turn sued the president for overstepping his authority. There's widespread concern that Trump may soon invoke the Insurrection Act that could lay the groundwork for martial law, the suspension of civil liberties, and the imposition of dictatorship. Many view Trump's recent actions as a test of how far he can go in eroding democratic checks and balances on his executive power. Your reporter spoke with Tamika Middleton, managing director of Women's March, who talks about the broad pro-democracy coalition's plans for the June 14th National No Kings protest, where Women's March is organizing over 300 political theater events they call Kick Out the Clown Circuses that will employ satire and humor to mirror the absurdity of the MAGA regime and the clowns who lead it.
We say, you know, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does teach us things. And so if we are paying attention to history, we can recognize the signals of this sort of strongman president organizing a military parade on his birthday, which also happens to be Flag Day, and sort of the conflation of patriotism with his own, you know, individual identity as a leader. And so there are a number of things happening on Saturday, a number of organizations that are mobilizing in response to this, in response to what feels like an escalation of this march towards fascism, towards authoritarianism. And so there are a couple things. One, I will say there is the mass action that you're referring to, that is a large coalition of organizations, that is No King's Day. That is one mass mobilization that is happening across the country. There are, of course, local folks who are taking action in a number of places. And Women's March, in particular, we're taking a different approach to this day than we have in the past. We're really taking our cues from what we have seen work in the fight against fascism in other countries and really tapping into political theater and humor and satire. And so what you mentioned, the Kick Out the Clowns, is sort of our attempt to really lean into that. We've been talking to organizers and reading about organizing in Serbia and other places where they've really sort of leaned into the invitation of humor for as both an invitation to people into the movement, but also as an intervention that brings some nuance and really starts to problematize and make the distinction between what we know as normalcy and the absurdity of the current government. And so we have, in addition to for the No King's Day efforts, we also have over 300 political circuses being planned around the country in all 50 states with our flagship event happening in Madison, Wisconsin, and really inviting folks to think about their activism in lots of different ways. Think about the ways that we can create a political dilemma for leadership. Think about the ways that we can invite our neighbors who may have voted for Trump to say, listen, let's look at the absurdity of what's actually happening right now. Let's look at what is impacting you, what is impacting all of us every single day. And let's bring more and more people into the fight that we're in right now. So, yes, again, so many different things taking place across the country. So many people getting involved and recognizing the absurdity, not just of, like you said, the military parade and then the mobilizing of the National Guard, but then also, you know, the sort of back and forth that's happening with Elon Musk and then the back and forth that's currently happening with Gavin Newsom. And so there's just a real absurdity to what is taking place that we want to really highlight and exploit in order to call the question for our neighbors and our friends and our community members who may have been sitting on the sidelines or may have been on the other side in this election and inviting them into conversation with us.
What's the goal of the protest? Maybe you could tell our listeners the succinct message that you're trying to get out there with likely hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people who will be participating in all these events across the U.S.
Yeah, Women's March, our goal is always to bring more people into the movement. So we are really thinking about not just how we get people into the streets, but how we move them into political homes and into formations on the other side of these actions. And so for us, it's really important all the time, and it's a place where we have struggled as a movement across a number of mobilization moments, where, you know, people get out in the streets and they get really activated and then we lose that momentum. And we are in a moment where we cannot afford to lose the momentum. That is one of the big goals that we have of this for us for this weekend is we want to activate people. We want to mobilize people, but then we want to activate them for the long haul. We want to connect them directly to organizations and to formations that they can plug into in their communities or nationally where they can continue to be in the fight and do the work. That's one big thing for us is that we find that mobilizations are the lowest barrier to entry into social movement work. And so we want people to come in. We want to be an on-ramp. And then the second thing that we really want to do is give people the skills to do this in their own communities. We give people toolkits. We do trainings. We do organizing calls where people begin to build their own skill to protest and resist in their communities. And so we are doing that constantly with these mobilizations. What we're up to is really trying to build a big tent, bring in more and more people, bring in everyday people, give them the skills that they need, and then support them in landing those skills on the ground so they can be fighting in their communities.
That was Tamika Middleton, Managing Director of Women's March. Learn more about the June 14th No Kings Day and Kick Out the Clowns protest actions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A sailboat named Madeline, bound for Gaza, carrying a symbolic supply of humanitarian aid to break Israel's blockade of food and medical provisions, was seized by the Israeli Navy in international waters on June 9th, 100 nautical miles from Gaza. The 12-member crew that was detained and later deported from Israel included Swedish climate and social justice activist Greta Thunberg and Rima Hassan, a French member of the European Parliament. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition that launched the Madeline has since 2008 attempted to break Israel's blockade with 31 boats, but only 5 reached Gaza. In 2010, Israeli commandos attacked the Mavi Marmara, a ship carrying humanitarian aid and 600 passengers. The assault killed 10 activists on board and injured dozens more. Your reporter spoke with Craig Mochaber, an international human rights lawyer and former director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, who resigned in protest over the unfolding Gaza genocide and the UN's failure to stop it. Here he discusses the Israeli seizure of the Madeline and pressure on the UN General Assembly to convene under a resolution called Uniting for Peace to deploy a protection force to Gaza, mandate a ceasefire, an Israeli arms embargo, and impose sanctions against the Netanyahu regime.
Israel has attacked and commandeered the UK-flagged ship, the Madeleine, named, by the way, for a Gaza official woman, and it has abducted all 12 of the unarmed civilian humanitarians who were on board, including Greta Thunberg and other humanitarians, many of them well-known. These were citizens of France and Spain and the Netherlands and Sweden and Germany and Brazil and Turkey, who were essentially, you know, sailing to Gaza to deliver baby formula for starving infant survivors of a genocide, together with other food and medical supplies. And they were sailing lawfully in international waters in the Mediterranean. They were heading toward Palestinian territorial waters. They were not heading toward Israel. They were never in or directed at Israeli territorial waters. And yet they were attacked by Israeli forces and abducted. And I should say also, Scott, this is not the first time. Just last month, another part of the Freedom Flotilla, a humanitarian ship called the Conscience, was bombed by Israeli quadcopters in international waters off the coast of Malta. And, you know, all of this comes in a context where the Israeli regime literally has the world record for the killing of humanitarians. In just the recent upsurge in genocide in the past year and a half, Israel has murdered 310 UN staff alone, UN humanitarians working in Gaza, many of them along with their families. And that's in addition to blocking of aid trucks and destruction of aid facilities and attacks on aid convoys. And frankly, because the government of the United States guarantees the impunity of the Israeli regime, including through the use of the veto, that regime has grown increasingly more and more bold in the perpetration of its international crimes. And that's why you see them doing something that people would have thought is unheard of, the attacking and commandeering and kidnapping of these humanitarians from the Madeleine.
Craig, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about yourself and others who are demanding that the United Nations General Assembly convene under a provision known as Uniting for Peace to deploy a force to Gaza to demand a ceasefire, implement sanctions against Israel, and hold Israeli officials accountable for war crimes committed in Gaza. Briefly summarize it for our listeners, if you would, and the chances that this could succeed.
Yeah, well, you know, all of the enforcement power of the international system rests with the Security Council. And the U.S., is wholly committed to Israeli impunity, has vetoed every resolution that has come before the Security Council, including five resolutions since this wave of genocide began, preventing a ceasefire, just a ceasefire. So what happens when the U.S. refuses to allow the Security Council to act by exercising its veto? The U.N. In the 1950s set up a mechanism called Uniting for Peace that allows the U.N. General Assembly, which is the democratic body of the U.N. that doesn't have a veto, to actually take up these kinds of issues and to adopt action. Now, the General Assembly doesn't have enforcement power, but it has in the past used this Uniting for Peace mechanism in order, for example, to send an emergency force to the Middle East in 1956 by getting the permission of those countries. I mean, Israel refused, but Egypt in this case agreed, so the emergency force could be deployed there. And that could be done here as well, because the World Court, the International Court of Justice, has ruled that Israel has no sovereignty over Gaza, has no right to be there, has no authority over it, and therefore the authority over admitting the UN belongs to the Palestinians. So with the permission of the Palestinians and the cooperation of Egypt and Jordan, ideally also for the West Bank, it would be possible for the General Assembly to mandate a UN emergency force, a UN protection force, and to send it there. And even if it didn't go in immediately, although I think that it should, it has the full legal right to do so, it could deploy on the borders in Egypt and the West Bank with monitoring equipment. It would be armed for self-defense. It would be charged with escorting in all of the medical aid and shelter and food and water and sanitation, everything that's needed for the survivors of the genocide. And they could also call, of course, for a ceasefire. They could call for sanctions and a military embargo against the Israeli regime. They could call for the establishment of an accountability mechanism like a tribunal to hold perpetrators accountable. They could reactivate the apartheid mechanisms of the UN. They could put pressure on the U.S. to lift the sanctions. The U.S. is now put sanctions on the International Criminal Court for indicting Israeli war criminals, and could demand a full return of UNRWA and other humanitarian agencies to the territory. And finally, to call for the implementation of the orders of the International Court of Justice in the genocide case against Israel, which has issued several provisional measures. It could do all of that if it has the political will to do so. And that only takes a majority of the member states, but I think it is entirely possible. Whether it will happen, I think, is an open question. There is a risk that with pressure from the U.S. and others, that the resolution that is adopted will simply again call for a ceasefire and repeat the worn-out old phrases of previous resolutions. But it is an opportunity for the international community to meet its obligation to respond to an ongoing genocide when the Security Council is unable to act because a co-perpetrator in that genocide, the United States government, uses its veto to block action.
That was Craig Mokhiber, former director of the New York office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. Find more news and commentary on Israel's seizure of the Madleen and calls for the UN to convene under a Uniting for Peace in Gaza resolution by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Trump administration is cutting every subsidy and tax rebate for clean energy under the Inflation Reduction Act passed by Congress and signed into law by President Biden in 2022. Trump and Republicans in Congress are also eliminating any other laws that promote the transition to clean energy that created hundreds of thousands of green jobs, many in red states. At the same time, the Trump regime is doubling down on dirty energy, gutting regulations on the development of gas, oil, and coal, which still receive billions of dollars a year in government subsidies, despite the industry being among the most profitable on Earth. Trump is also requiring that power plants using fossil fuels be kept in operation, even those that were slated to be closed down because of their hazardous pollution or weren't economically viable. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Colin Reese, U.S. Program Manager with Oil Change International. Here he explains the state of play for both renewable energy sources and fossil fuels, and says there's still time to head off these disastrous changes in the budget bill that passed the House by only one vote and is now being debated in the Senate.
What we're seeing is Republicans and Donald Trump taking a sledgehammer to clean energy incentives that have reduced pollution, created hundreds of thousands of jobs, and lowered electricity bills for working families. And they're doing that all in order to attempt to justify gigantic tax breaks for the rich, for fossil fuel companies in particular, for the donors who put them in office, and for the wealthiest Americans. The way they're doing it, I think, is really insidious. We have a tax code that for far too long, for decades, even over a century in many cases, has been tilted toward propping up the fossil fuel industry, toward boosting oil and gas profits, coal industry as well, although not as much these days. But our tax code is overwhelmingly incentivizing fossil fuel production already. That has been the case for a very long time. And even something like the Inflation Reduction Act, which was an important step forward in terms of supporting clean energy. Even in the Inflation Reduction Act, we saw tens of billions of dollars of new incentives for additional fossil fuel production. Even in recent years, we've continued to add new fossil fuel subsidies, even as it's incredibly clear that we can't afford to produce or burn more fossil fuels to stay within our climate limits, let alone our sort of global commitments. There are approximately 6 to 8 times more permanent tax breaks for fossil fuels than there are for renewable energy. And I'll say, despite that uncertainty, despite a lack of investment, and despite the federal government's priorities and investments being tilted toward fossil fuels, even in the present moment, clean energy has still made enormous gains. There has been a huge growth in clean energy over the years, and the Inflation Reduction Act was an important step continuing that growth. That is the way the entire world is growing. There's been the beginnings of an American industry built up around actually supporting clean energy. we're seeing not only a continuation of all the existing fossil fuel tax breaks, but they're also even thinking about new ways to give more handouts to polluters, new ways to further subsidize this industry. They're talking about further lowering royalty rates, making it even easier for oil companies to drill on our frack on our public lands, on our public waters. Some more complicated pieces like exempting oil and gas companies from even the corporate minimum tax rate, the absolute bare minimum that all corporations must pay in terms of taxes, which is already far too low. They're talking about giving exemptions to that for just oil and gas companies. And this is happening at the same time that they're attacking clean energy tax breaks. They're removing some of the few that were already there and making it extraordinarily harder to build out renewable energy in many ways.
So when you said this administration is taking a sledgehammer to the clean energy tax credits and all the things that made it possible to build out a lot of clean energy, is there anything left?
There are some important incentives left, and I think it's very important to know that this fight isn't over. What we've seen with the Inflation Reduction Act is the benefits of this clean energy expansion are accruing to all Americans. This is happening across the country. It's happening in blue districts. It's happening in purple districts. It's happening in red districts. It's happening perhaps even more so in conservative-leaning districts as they're seeing the benefits of these clean energy projects and of these investments. And so it's not an easy vote for all members of Congress to say, get rid of these things. It's been a topic of much discussion. It is one of the core sticking points for a lot of Republicans to be able to vote for this bill is how much of those incentives it will remove when they start to phase out, that sort of thing, because they know that they're going to have to go home to their districts and explain this to very angry constituents in many cases. It's not like it's going to be impossible to build clean energy. In fact, the opposite. The global transition to renewables is happening. Actions like this from the Trump administration are not going to stop that transition. I think that's really important to understand. But we are in danger of causing the U.S. to fall even further behind, both in terms of the rest of the world in clean energy manufacturing and in terms of our climate targets. The transition is inevitable, but how that transition looks and how just it is for workers, for communities, and for the climate is yet to be determined. So I think that's really the terrain of struggle that we're talking about here. It's still going to be possible to put solar on your house, but it will be increasingly difficult for clean energy projects, for instance, to be built on federal lands if the Trump administration gets its ways. So there are many different pieces of this, but right now the Trump administration is trying to close down a whole lot of those fronts and give even more benefits to the polluters. But there's a lot of opportunity to get some of the worst parts out to lessen the damage that this bill would do, including on the fossil fuel front.
That was Colin Reese, U.S. Program Manager with Oil Change International. Learn more about the effort to stop the elimination of clean energy incentives in the Trump budget bill by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KBCS in Bellevue, Washington, REC Delmarva nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.